It's Magnum Podcast, the holiday special. I'm Jason Snell. Isn't it special? We watch Magnum PI like we always do, but we're calling it a special. I'm joined, as always, by David J. Lohr and Philip Michaels. Hi, guys. Happy holidays, guys.
Let me clue you in on something, okay? We got a plot problem in this episode.
Oh, L.A., the big banana, the city that only sleeps until noon, the third city, the city that knows how, by which I mean James Ward Howe, the famous cinematographer. Yeah, L.A., baby.
Starville. Actor Town.
Christmas Town, USA.
Dodgerville.
All of those Christmases in L.A., so snowy and white. Why wouldn't you pick this for your Christmas
season
episode?
Seven, episode one and two, if you're counting, but really it was a two-part episode. It was two-hour special season premiere. L.A. is the name, as you can see, because it appears at the beginning of the episode in very large type.
Over the cityscape of Honolulu.
Of Honolulu.
Yes.
At which point I yelled out, no.
No.
No, not correct.
It's very confusing. So this is our holiday special. We're wrapping up our season. We're going to talk about the LA episode. We got some segments. We got a letter.
And when they broke it up into two parts for syndication, one episode is titled L, the other A.
Yes. And you watched them in alphabetical order, which was a problem.
Yes, I did.
I'd like to introduce an early segment.
What? You said you had no segments before we started, you dirty liar.
That was until I opened my mouth and said something stupid. I earlier described the famous cinematographer James Ward Howe. He is, in fact, James Wong Howe.
Oh.
I wasn't going to say anything.
So that was a correction segment there.
Yes, it's a correction segment. Yes, I was. It's, I got... Somehow I got the cinematographer James Wong Howe confused with the football player James Ward Prowse. And now, boy, is my face red, redder than Santa's fat belly.
So this is a segment called I Am My Own Christmas Ombudsman.
Mm-hmm. Ombud yourself. Mm-hmm. This is an episode in which Magnum goes to L.A. And a way to kick off your Hawaii-themed TV show's seventh and possibly final, until they decided not to, season. I'll have more on that later, with this episode that's set in L.A. It involves Magnum's kind of meet-cute with a stand-up comedian, and he also he meets a lawyer who he's serving papers to, because apparently Robin Masters wants Magnum to serve papers in L.A.,
Is implied that previous process servers were duped and tricked. So
right, and Magnum
Robin is calling in the big guns
in the professional here. And then there is a case that involves murder and also drug trafficking that Magnum follows throughout in a 2-hour episode that I would charitably describe as slow paced.
Well, and you know, so that I remember in 1986 when this aired, and you know, you go, oh, it's been on 7 years, you know, they're going to spend money, they're going away to another location. When Hawaii Five-0 had been on for 6-7 years, they went off and they did this big episode in Hong Kong. You know, it was really, really exciting. It was
Magnum
fun to watch.
Did
and
you go, the London episodes, right?
Magnum
like,
did
oh,
the
look
London
at that.
Ones, and you go, they went to L.A.
This had the feel of Tom Selleck was filming a movie during the summer, and it lingered, and they quickly said, all right, we'll just do an L.A. episode with Tom Selleck only, and all of our friends will be stuck in Hawaii.
And it is the first episode that TWS Productions joins the masthead at the end. That's Selleck's own company. And it's like, oh, maybe that wasn't a good idea.
It's this episode. I think this is an okay 1-hour Magnum episode stretched to double time, and I think that's part of the problem with it. There is also, which we should get to, I think, right off the bat, there is also a B plot, and it's like a B plot from one episode strung out over multiple episodes, because very little happens in it. So
it is literally this could have all been fixed with a phone call episode.
Yeah.
Because so, it is fixed with a phone
so
call.
So let's start. Three kids steal an expensive car. Mm-hmm. One of the kids is TV's Alfonso Ribeiro, and he says to the other guys, hey, you didn't say we were stealing a car. You said we were taking a car from your uncle. And he's like, well, you didn't expect. The kid says something like, well, you didn't take me literally, did you? He's like, yes, I did. You said you were taking the car from your uncle.
We were picking up a car for your uncle. We're not. Well, I mean, technically they picked up a car, but it's not even his uncle.
And no, and they steal it. And so he's very upset. And he says, I'm out of here. And he is, of course, Kenny. He plays on TC's baseball team, the Tigers.
I'm just happy that we have a clip of Alfonso Ribeiro having a moral dilemma and not breaking out into song about Mr. Robinson's window. So I think that's great.
Or doing the Carlton.
Ask your parents, children.
This storyline continues where in the next scene, the two kids, I'm just going to walk through this whole thing. The two kids who knew they were stealing the car are where they've got the car and they're going to, you know, it's a chop shop or whatever. The doors open and two men are seen in silhouette holding machine guns. And you think to yourself, surely the children are not going to be shot down in an artful slow motion sequence by machine gun fire. And the answer is, oh, yes, they are. Indeed. They are.
They're going to be filled full of lead. And also, though, to be fair, the bullet to child ratio is off the charts.
Yeah.
Those assassins are not accurate whatsoever. Well,
but it's the 80s. In 80s TV, all the bad guys had machine guns, and they sprayed the Uzis.
Yeah, they
everywhere.
They fill the entire Honolulu port with enough buckshot to.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I should say there is an interstitial scene that we're going to have to get to, but I just wanted to jump to the fact that Alfonso Ribeiro then runs in, sees that his two friends have been filled full
brutally murdered,
and they shoot at him and he runs away and he hides. So the other scene is that we discover he's Kenny from the baseball team because he's very troubled when he goes to the baseball game. And TC says, I'm going to talk to you later. Of course, they are the Tigers. They've got the red hat with the T. There'll be a hat segment later. They've sold tickets to this game for the Anglo-Hawaiian Home for Incorrigible Boys.
Just love it.
Continuing that bit. And Higgins is going to sell concessions because Magnum had to run off to do a job in L.A., as we know. So he has a little white outfit with a hat, and he goes and actually says, hot dogs, peanuts, get your red hots here, says Higgins as he walks off. We will not see him again.
I wanted that scene to go on forever. I had hoped that the B plot or even C plot would have been a day in the life of Jonathan Higgins,
peanut
food
vendor.
Yes.
Yeah.
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 I'd like
a sandwich. Do you have a sandwich? Sir, unless you consider a hot dog a sandwich, which I frankly do not. I do not have a sandwich here. Perhaps you would like a hot dog. Right, it's the shenanigans of like,
and because if the episode is L.A., they could have had that peanut guy from L.A. who does the wacky peanut throws, and no, that's not how you do it, you crazy butler,
Higgy baby. No.
I literally have halfway down my notes. My headcanon wants to know what Rick and Higgins are up to because that's way more interesting. And then we find out, and I go, oh, well,
yeah. So. Mm. So after the kids are brutally murdered again, we go back and Tanaka and TC are there with the body body outlines of the dead kids. They're investigating this and they're like, but where is Kenny? Their plot is essentially the search for Kenny, and the search for Kenny just keeps on going on. However, like in the A plot, which we'll get to in a minute. A long time happens, at which point it cuts back to Tanaka and TC and now Rick, seemingly at the same crime scene.
Yes, they came back.
Yeah. I guess, but it feels very much like they never
left.
They've
been there the whole time, yeah.
Well, they've been holding a vigil for Kenny, as one does. I also, the guy I really feel badly for, again, is the crime lab technician who has to leave all those numbers about the shells that they found.
Yeah.
There's a lot of shells. Yeah,
my stickers don't go that high.
Lieutenant, I don't have past 999. I just...
TC very cleverly points out, well, you know, Kenny's going to be wanted by the killers because he saw them. Kenny is still hiding. And then we move on to part two. They're still looking for Kenny. And then later, TC calls around looking for information about Kenny, and he gets a tip from one of the kids on the team about where Kenny might be hiding. And he finds Kenny. But the bad guys are also there. Fortunately, Tanaka is there wearing a baseball team, Tigers baseball team hat. The red hat.
See, they pulled the switcheroo.
Well, they switched.
They had Tanaka drive TC's van, posing as TC,
yes,
wearing a hat, going to the place where they wanted to lead the killers to. Whereas yes, TC went to a totally different part of the island where Kenny was hiding
and found Kenny. Yes, so one guy
that's
shot.
The intricate plotting of
one guy
of
shot
LA.
The other guy's not. They arrest them. Tanaka's very happy wearing his Tigers team hat, and that's the search for Kenny. There's nothing to it.
But, you know, it stretches for 2 hours. It's fine. It's fine.
Wow. All right, the other plot. And there's...
You said that it's more involved than the Kenny plot. Really? Really, only by degrees.
Well, there's two things that have been kind of like mashed together here. So Magnum is talking on a moving sidewalk at the airport to a blonde lady who is saying,
doesn't shut up.
You should come out with me and do this thing, have a truly spontaneous good time. They're at the baggage carousel. She's like, come on, you should do it. He's like, I'm too busy.
I would like to interrupt with a segment.
Yes, okay.
my second segment, in which Magnum PI airport faux pas.
Yes.
Magnum is on that moving sidewalk. Standing on the left side. The side where you're supposed to be walking, having a conversation. People are trying to get around Thomas Magnum because, again, he's a hulking giant.
Yes.
And, this immediately made me reassess. Maybe this is Magnum in season 7 signaling he's going to be a brutal anti-hero because that is the stuff of war criminals to actually stand in the walking part of the moving sidewalk.
Well, you know, one thing that strikes me about this episode, as soon as he's in Los Angeles, you know, what do we think of when we think of Magnum? We think of a Ferrari. We think of Hawaiian shirts and tropical colors. Mm-hmm. And he's on the moving walkway in this sort of grayish off-white tunnel. And he's wearing beige and off-white and gray. And that's his color palette for the whole episode. His cars are gray and off-white. What? Who thought this was a good idea?
Phil, as we know, Slobodan Milosevic always stood on the left side of the moving walkway. Mm-hmm. He didn't push his chair in after he stood up from the table.
Yeah, huh?
And he didn't stand behind the wait here line.
I was once on an escalator, walking up the escalator to get to a meeting. There was Slobodan Milosevic standing in my way. I said, excuse me. He says, no, I stand here. Also, I killed many people.
One of his greatest crimes, he's standing on the escalator. War crimes.
Yes.
So anyway, there is a funny moment where she sees a man at the other end of the baggage carousel, and she looks a little bit disturbed by that, and Magnum notices this. And says, isn't he a little old for you? And she said, yeah, he is. He's like 40 or something. Magnum does a double take. But I'm 40.
And looks at the camera.
I had my midlife crisis where I stalked a lady when I turned 40. Go back to that episode. It actually happened. Anyway, hooray for Hollywood. She is a stand-up comedian. She is at this lady who won't stop talking at Lila's Comedy Hangout. Zany title. She is a comedian. She got the 8:15 spot because she makes Lila, the manager of the club, laugh apparently, and she does her comedy routine intercut with the two kids getting horribly murdered in machine guns.
And she's talking about a scary movie, and we get the intercut with the silent. You don't get to hear the gunshots or any of that stuff. In this weird homage to The Godfather, as far as I can tell, except with stand-up comedy instead of opera.
Yep.
And just...
On this day, Carrot Top settles all his family business.
That's right. That's right. You go to the novelty mattresses.
Paulie Shore sleeps with the fishes.
I would like
Buddy.
Magnum here engages in the thing that I...
You come here on the day of Joel Hodgson's wedding to ask me for a favor?
Someday, and this day may never come, I may ask of you a cream pie in the face.
The thing I love hate about stand-up comedy in TV and movies.
Take the prop comedy, leave the cannoli.
Oh, my God. Is that you have a... It's always a manic stand-up comic performing a not funny at all routine.
Oh, yes.
And cut to the audience doubling over as if they're seeing Dino and Jerry at the Copacabana in 1953.
She's killing it.
Yeah.
She's killing it. Marty's killing it. So, anyway, they cut back to Magnum's hotel room and she's there and she's like, "What a week. I won a trip to Hawaii. I got the 8:15 spot at the comedy hangout, and now you buy me a pizza? Things are great.
Things are finally looking up for old Marty."
Yeah, and she says, "You must be tired." And I'm thinking, this is an interesting, quirky character that we're going to get to know a lot about. She says, "You must be tired, with the time zones and all." And Magnum says, in a moment that will go down in Magnum podcast history, Magnum says, "But that's not how the time zones work in Hawaii." And I thought, now we know about time zones, Magnum. Now we know.
He must have read about them on the flight over. Now that's how time works.
It goes the other direction.
Oh, wow.
I could have been watching baseball earlier.
I actually almost wonder, especially since this is at the start of a season, I almost wonder if this is actually a reference to people calling them on their bad time zones throughout history of the show. Anyway, she wants to stay there. She's looking out the window at a menacing blue sedan that is outside that has been following her. Obviously, something is going on here. Magnum is going to figure it out eventually. But what happens is Magnum leaves and then comes back to the room and hears her screaming and runs up to see that the apartment's open. And he's looking and we don't see anybody. And I'm like, oh, no, they kidnapped her. And then he looks in the bathroom. Oh, no, she's dead in the shower. I had a legitimate moment of like, well, wait a second. You've now brutally murdered the kids and the woman who was presumably our guest star in the first 15 minutes of our special 2-hour Magnum PI. Wow.
And because
this is season seven, telling you who it is, because the bodies are going to pile up this season.
Oh, yeah. Ooh. And because those were intercut, clearly those two plots are connected.
No.
Right?
Nope. Not at all.
And so, yeah, this is the season that brings us Death and Taxes. This is the season where they try and do Miami Vice every now and then.
Yes, indeed.
This is an episode that does Miami Vice and a little bit of Moonlighting.
A little bit.
But very little.
So,
Mona Miller, by the way.
Yes.
Who plays Marty Jensen.
Yes.
This is her only credit listed in IMDb, and that is puzzling to me. Did they literally kill her on the set?
She seems really interesting, and I wonder, maybe she's like a theater actress who never really
A stand-up comedian.
She is
a stand-up comedian. Okay.
Which makes the whole bad stand-up comedy even more confusing to me.
Yeah.
I was just surprised because this episode is set up that it's going to be Magnum and Marty, and then she's just whacked.
She's dead.
What is happening?
Surprise!
Little LA noir going on there. Okay, so for the rest
it's one of the best twists in all of Magnum PI.
The rest of, according to magnum-mania.com.
Stealing the crown from Black on White.
So the rest of this episode is basically he serves the lawsuit to Dana Delaney. Okay, Dana Delaney is producing a movie. She's a lawyer, but she's producing a movie funded by dentists that is very clearly based on a Robin Masters novel, but the screenwriter said it wasn't. And so they are trying, Robin is suing to shut it all down. When he meets her, he serves her with papers pretending to be, he says that his name is the name of a childhood
sweetheart.
Yeah, an old flame of hers. But it's not. It's Magnum. He serves her. And then her response is to insult him by saying, "You are a conniving, double-talking civil servant." To which Magnum has to turn around and say, "I am not a civil servant."
That
and I'm thinking to myself, "You insult me, ma'am. You insult me. The ultimate insult. A civil servant I am not."
I mean, I mean, you can call me a PI. You can call me a private eye. I'm still going to correct you and say I'm a private investigator. But
do
it's
not
okay.
call me a,
but
a
you
civil
do not
servant.
Call me a civil servant.
I will not serve, and I'm not civil.
If being civil, I will not
but,
serve.
But then he sees a blonde lady walk by, which is so rare in L.A., and he is noticeably upset. And Dana Delaney says, "Hey, come on, we're having a fight here." And he says, "Oh no, it's just the smog." And in a first that will be repeated throughout this episode, she says, "I knew I should have stayed home today." And he says, "No, I would have just checked there." And she says, "That's what I meant." Because whenever there's romantic tension in this episode, there will be a saxophone. Listen for the sound of the saxophone.
And wouldn't it have been so much better if it had been the sax solo from Baker Street?
It would
I mean,
have...
that improves everything.
Yeah, but it wasn't. It was just, it was other saxophone music.
Or Clarence Clemons from one of the E Street Band
sure.
albums, I think, for a more for a more peppy.
Well, so, from Santa Claus is Coming to Town.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So
because this is a Christmas episode.
He can't
let Marty become another case. He finds a suspicious clipping. He's driving an annoying talking rental car. He rips out the thing that makes it talk. That was a thing in the 80s. They had the like, lights are on, lights are on, lights are
door
on.
Door is ajar.
I mean, exactly. I mean, if there is one thing I'm amused by in this episode, and there are very few things I'm amused by in this episode, it is that Magnum is driving a VW Rabbit.
Yeah.
That's cute.
Magnum-Mania says, this is obviously a reference to Knight Rider. No, it's not. It's a reference to stupid talking cars of the 80s. That's what it's a reference to. Anyway, he finds her suitcase in the trunk, Marty's suitcase. It's got the classic Hawaii Agriculture Inspection sticker on the side. That took me back. We had those stickers on our suitcases in the 80s. There's a flyer there for a crusading Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. That won't be important later.
No.
In a funny, weird moment, Magnum goes to the house where Marty was staying, and he's...
Yes.
And it's got security cameras, and the mysterious sedan is following him. But he breaks and enters like usual, vaults over a fence to find a red sports car and two barking dogs. And he runs away from the dogs and tries to pick the lock and says, "Don't look at the dogs. Don't look at the dogs. I looked at the dogs." We are replaying episode one of Magnum PI. And in fact, he comments, "I know what's happening here. She is clearly living in a guest house, sponging off a rich person while trying to figure out her life. I see what you did there."
And she has a green rubber chicken.
Yeah.
As opposed to the standard yellow rubber chicken. Yeah. Also, the dogs who are the stand-ins for Zeus and Apollo are really Bacchus and Dionysus, judging by their body type. Those are some fat watchdogs.
Those are chunky dogs.
I think they're Rottweilers.
Big chunguses. Sure.
Instead of Dobermans? Yeah, I think that's what it is.
And this is the point where I wrote down, this is Bizarro Magnum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's what it is.
That's the idea, like, here. And so he and Marty were like two sides of the same coin or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Perhaps in another life they could have become friends.
Perhaps.
And considering Bizarro Magnum, I have a segment.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, what is this? It's this weird, like, almost feels like a Magnum, but it's not a Magnum, but it is.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a little quiz
okay.
for the two of you.
I'm excited. I never get to participate in the quizzes.
Well, and I you know, we could say this one is a little bit Jason's fault because
sure.
I went to the AI.
Oh,
and,
God.
Oh, no.
And found, came up with some ideas for art. You know, what Magnum, as portrayed by various artists and cartoonists over the past, you know, 50, 60 years. So if you will look in your chat, I will give you the first one. Let's see, can I do this way? Yes, I can.
Don't worry, we'll get it right when we record.
Yeah, we'll get it right on the after the dress.
This is good enough for a dress
this
rehearsal.
Is great podcasting.
So, for instance, this first one is drawn by one of the more famous cartoonists in the last century.
Yes.
Any idea who it might be? Let's start with Phil.
I'm gonna guess that it's I'm torn. I'm gonna go with I'm thrown by the uniform. I'm going to say it's Mort Cooper because it has kind of a Beetle Bailey feel to it.
No, it's Charles Schultz.
You're supposed to let me steal it. Come on.
I'm sorry. Okay, I will go back to
very
choice.
Clearly Charlie Brown without any eyes next to a red car.
Well, he's blinded by.
I mean, it's the interesting thing is just like before, the AI knows that you have a red car and you have a mustache. Mm-hmm. Everything else is weird.
It's very fitting that you should have Charlie Brown, because later on when we meet crusading reporter Jesse Hermano, he is wearing basically a Charlie Brown sweater with the zigzag.
Yes, yes, I noticed that.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's in the episode we're supposed to be talking about.
Yeah, God, but who cares about that, that piece of crap?
Well, so now here's one for you, Jason.
It's Christmas.
Again, cartoonist style.
I don't know, Al Hirschfeld?
No, good guess, but it's Matt Groening.
No, it's not.
No, it's not. It really is not.
For one thing, he's not a rabbit.
Yeah, and he doesn't have an underbite.
Mm-hmm. The AI really has a problem with mustaches.
Slash obsession.
A little bit.
Yeah.
So,
is this still happening?
This one.
Okay. Yep.
This is still happening. Oh, yeah.
Well, it tastes like the episode.
You will long for the days of Lego Man.
We're looking for Kenny right now. That's what we're doing.
Oh, my heavens.
So here's one for you, Phil. I will say,
even
this doesn't even make sense, but I'll give you the hint. They're known for stop motion, which makes it even weirder.
Rankin and Bass.
There you go.
Without the clue, I would have guessed Chuck Jones, because it has that kind of Chuck Jones.
I was going to say Hanna-Barbera, because it looks like that speed buggy there.
Oh, that's
true. Yeah, that's good, too.
The
yeah.
car does look like it has a mustache.
Uh-huh.
So it's melded with Magnum.
And now this might be a gimme for Jason.
That looks like a Miyazaki Magnum.
Spot on. That is Miyazaki.
Well, we're tied at one. Is there a tiebreaker?
Well, we got two more here. This one is for you, Phil. And I'm so sorry. Because this is a cartoonist known for hating Mondays.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
I swear to God.
That this is Garfield.
This is Garfield.
You sure it's not President Garfield?
Yeah, it's like
it's Richard Nixon cosplaying as Stalin.
Yeah, Charles Gateau, the killer of Garfield.
This one is for Jason. This one might also be a gimme. This is not an artist per se.
Well, it's just the like Jim Henson or the Muppets or Sesame Street or something.
It's Sesame Street. Yeah.
That's the Children's Television Workshop.
Yes.
Because
you've got that
teaching
sort of
about
broken...
the and then the letter of the day is the Soviet hammer and sickle, apparently.
Yes.
In that one, a mustached Julia Louis-Dreyfus and a mustached, I don't know who that other guy is, blockheaded guy, visit with some Muppets.
The Muppets have gone full QAnon is what I'm going to guess.
Yeah, Avenue QAnon is what's going on. Uh-huh.
And so I have just two more.
Oh, you already said there were two more. How
we're
is it
tied.
That there's still two more?
We're still tied. We're still tied.
I knew I shouldn't have answered that question wrong just to end this.
So this is a cartoonist that, Phil, you impersonated on a recent episode.
The Hagar the Horrible guy, I would
guess. That's right.
Does not look anything like... Hello!
Nope, that's like an episode of Archer.
Hagar the Horrible. This is an insult to my work. This is the second episode in a row where you have defamed me and not even included my good friend Mort Cooper, unless he's the second one. I don't know.
That guy is sounding more and more like Michael Vigazzo all the time.
He's getting there.
Well, I guess I've gotten older. I've lost all my voices.
We've never seen them together.
No.
Now this one.
Lucky Eddie, you're gonna do a thing for me.
The only clue I have for you, because this makes no sense, you already answered this one and were wrong before.
Al Hirschfeld?
Al Hirschfeld.
Doesn't look like that at all.
I was going to guess Salvador Dali.
Yeah. That's closer, yeah.
It looks like a nightmare thing that Salvador Dali would do.
And again, more Ron Swanson and Stalin than Magnum P.I.
Yep.
Are we done now, David?
This one is non-competitive. This is non-competitive, but since you kept bringing up Beetle Bailey, this is what the AI showed for Beetle Bailey.
That is not
Beetle Bailey.
I don't think you know how to use the AI, David. I don't think you use it right.
I just said Magnum P.I. drawn by Mort Walker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was Mort Walker. It was actually Mort Wong Walker, Mort Cooper.
Yes.
But anyway.
So what happens is that we meet Detective J.A. Preston. Or no, J.A. Preston, the actor, plays Detective McKee. J.A. Preston, you know him. He's been in a million things.
He's the judge in A Few Good Men.
He is.
That's right.
He's in so many.
You will address the court as your honor. I'm sure I've earned it. That's a great reading.
He is Detective McKee. Magnum explains, because he's been caught at the house that is the mirror image Robin Masters estate, that he's trying to figure out who killed the girl, and that he suspects the light blue town car and the guy at the airport. He describes them, and he literally hands him a picture and says it's this is Anton Peters, a major drug supplier. This is our Miami Vice plot. And then, you know, I don't know. So
just as you thought that, oh, well, he's going to hang out with Marty for the rest of this episode, I thought, well, he and Lieutenant McKee are going to become best pals.
Nope.
And this is the pilot for their LA spinoff.
Yeah. But instead, McKee sends him to a safe house. He gets there. There are guys there who shoot at him with machine guns, of course. His car explodes in the truest traditions of Chips, which treats every car as a potential incendiary device ready to go off at any moment.
It's a very Southern California thing, Jason. If you grew up in Southern California in the 70s and 80s, you were used to cars just spontaneously blowing up.
Yeah, well, I mean, especially
if you should have been a Pinto.
If you fire in them with a machine gun. Apparently, there is according to Magnum-Mania.com, the official Bible of Magnum Podcast, there is a 1 minute long scene that appeared in the original episode and appears in some of the syndicated versions, but is not on the DVDs and is not on the iTunes version, where there is a deleted scene where Magnum flees after the car explosion and goes through various backyards, meets a playmate of the month briefly, and then continues on and shows up at Delaney's house because he has nowhere else to go. She opens the door. Magnum is there. And you know what happens next?
Saxophone.
Saxophone.
Yeah.
So here's the weird thing. Because I ripped it off my DVD and put it into Plex so it'd be easy to watch on the Apple TV.
Yes.
And, you know, so I knew that this scene is missing in the DVD. Whatever. The thumbnail that Plex picks out of thin air for this is Kim MacArthur in her hot tub, which you never see.
Is the scene that's removed. Wild.
Yep.
That's wild.
It's bizarre.
It's on like the German DVD, apparently, but not on the American DVD. Oh,
it's funny that you should mention that they cut out
Magnum.
The scene. Because as I was watching the episode, I watch these at night, and I sometimes fall asleep. I'm an old man, you know? And I thought, did I pass out momentarily? Because it feels like this Dana Delaney, Thomas Magnum relationship progressed very steadily in a scene that I have no memory of. Because they are thick as thieves now.
There is no pacing. There is no. I mean, this is a very choppily edited episode too. Even forgetting that scene, it's just a mess.
It is. When he gets to Dana Delaney's house, by the way, they've got the TV on, and Sam McKee, the detective we just met, was murdered just this evening. So much for that spinoff. Another dead body for L.A.
And they saying, police are saying it's not connected to the shootout at his house. You are the worst cops in the world.
Yeah. Well, it is the LAPD.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just a kawinky dink, as it turns out.
So
it's not the Jack Webb days.
So Dan Delaney says, what are we doing here? How about I call a guy I know who is a cop? Maybe that can solve this. And Magnum says, all right, let's do that tomorrow. But for now, let's kiss. The saxophone comes back. So Dana Delaney. I know that some people we know love her. And if you know their memory of the China Beach era and all of that, I know that we are all mixed on her in this episode. I think there's something here. I think that Dana Delaney is a very likable actress, and that this character they're trying to create this connection between her and Magnum that starts out as it's a meet cute, you know, where they're adversaries, but then they kind of warm up to each other and they try it here. This character is a little bit wacky. She like always wants to be involved, but like, I like her. I don't love this character, but I like the actress. And I think that shines through a little bit, but, the best way I can describe her character in this episode is if you had told me that in season 7, Magnum gets that girlfriend character we've been talking about throughout, and that she's in the show for the rest of it, and they get married at the end. And I saw this episode, I'd be like, I see what they're doing here. Because that's really kind of what it feels like, is that they need to do the work to lay the groundwork to explain why Dana Delaney's in Magnum PI now. And spoiler alert for this episode that we're talking about, she isn't in Magnum PI now. She's in one more episode at the end of the season. But that's the part that strikes me as weird about this, is it kind of feels like they're trying to write her into the show, except then they don't.
Yeah. The setup is, you know, it's still kind of clumsy, but it's there and it makes sense. And, you know, when she does, and the way they leave this, I mean, we'll just jump to that for a split second.
Sure.
They do leave it at, you know, well, we have a connection now and I'll be there at some point.
Yeah. When it's not as intense as it is when we're running for our lives, with guys with Uzis shooting at us, which I totally get. And then she does come back in the third from last episode of this season.
When she does come back, it is literally a waste of time.
Okay. So I'm going to lay it out here now, and then Phil can tell us how terrible Dana Delaney is and how he hates her. But I just want to lay this theory out. I have a theory, and it's not backed up by anything other than watching this episode and knowing where it fits in the Magnum canon. Mm-hmm. I think they were toying with the idea of marrying Magnum off to Dana Delaney at the end of the season when the show wraps. I think that was in play as a possible ending for the show. And that's why they dangled her out there. That's why they set her up here. And in the end, it's why they ultimately decided against it and brought her back right before the end of the series and had it sort of had it not work out. But I get some real vibes here, knowing that this is what was going to be the last season of Magnum PI, that maybe she was one of their options, either to shake up the show or more likely to end the show with Magnum going off with Dana Delaney happily ever after. That's what it feels like to me, because it doesn't make sense otherwise.
At some point midway through the season, they thought, well, yeah, it is definitely going to be the last year, but let's kill him off.
Yeah, we've got another idea. We'll kill him off instead.
Yeah. So then it's like, yeah, we gotta wrap this up.
That's my theory, is that this was on their short list of ways they could end the show, was to marry him off to Dana Delaney. So they had her floating out there as a possibility for Magnum.
But then how does that square with the stupid Michelle plots that they kept floating around?
I don't like to think about those. Although there's dialogue in this episode where he's like, you know, I think that I'm married, but I'm not married.
I was married. She goes, I got married. And she goes, oh. As well, kind of, and I'm not now, but I might be, and but they do bring it up,
yes,
and that might have been an interesting thing to play with,
right?
You know,
except,
but
and
then
this
they
is,
don't.
This is my point: is that they go to the trouble of casting Dana Delaney. They she is they're working real hard to establish their relationship in this 2-hour series or season premiere. And I
so
get to the end and I think,
working hard.
Why did we spend so much effort on this? She comes back briefly and that's it. Like, why? And I have to think there was an ulterior motive at play here. Phil, why do you hate Dana Delaney so much?
I don't hate Dana Delaney so much. I don't. I find her. I think she rarely fits in with the projects that she does. I haven't really seen China Beach at all. But just judging from shows like this or Tombstone, which she is in as the love interest for Kurt Russell's Wyatt Earp, she sticks out in that movie like she has been jetted in from another movie. There's this scene in Tombstone where Kurt Russell is out riding and he runs into her and she says, "Oh, Mr. Earp, oh, this is fortuitous. That means lucky." And it is such a leaden line reading that my wife and I will occasionally say, "This is fortuitous," and then lean to the other one and go, "That means lucky." And and I guess that just sort of is the overriding thing I think of when I see Dana Delaney. I'm sure she's a lovely person. I'm sure that she's probably good in many things. And I've not seen them, and I wish her all the best. And
I mean,
good
like
for her.
I did see Exit to Eden.
Yeah, well, you were the one.
Yeah,
I was the one.
Uh-huh.
And she is in that.
Yeah,
is what I can say. China Beach is kind. She's in a totally different gear. It's kind of amazing.
And that's the impression I get is that's the show where she was the match for the material, and that's why.
Right. And she's terrific. So well. And even at that, I'm not a huge fan of the series until the final season when they're not in Vietnam. It's all the post-Vietnam stuff. And each episode bounces from year to year. It's a totally non-linear season. It's amazing. And of course it got canceled. So
So here, you know, I don't think she would have worked on the show, but as it feels to me like they're establishing a relationship in case they want to use this as a way out of the show in some way.
If they were doing that, it seems like they thought better of it in between the commercial break right before the end.
It does.
Well, and it's
I think they wanted to spit. They knew they had to do a season worth, right? So they put her out there and they had her just sort of like sitting out there as she says she's coming back. We can bring Dana Delaney back at any point. And then they got to the end of the season. They're like, I guess we'll just bring her back.
We haven't brought her back yet, but we left it hanging.
And, yeah, so let's bring her back and just end it. And have it
honestly, towards the end of this episode, Lisa and I both thought this was going to be like a bonanza thing where
she dies at the end.
She gets crushed by a wagon wheel and Hoss is sad because he doesn't
And
get
little
to
Joe
it.
Is brokenhearted.
It's very sad.
I mean, Having seen the episode with Margaret Collin from season 8, which is, I mean, the chemistry is so much more.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is that kind of character in a minor key. Like they're really trying to make that work. And they know that Selleck can do that kind of fast banter back and forth. And I don't know if it's the writing in this because it's not great writing, and I don't know if it's the direction because the direction is just all over the place.
It's too bad too because this is an Abbott Fish script, and I had really thought that it would be better. But
she's really good, but this is not good.
And again,
maybe that's from Selleck.
And I wonder if this really was
producer.
I wonder if this really was just a single episode that got blown up into two and it got stretched and you lost all the velocity of it, and you know maybe they even gave her the rules of like, well, you have to insert this character and get her built up because of reasons that they didn't actually do. I don't know.
And the other thing about the character is she turns on a dime multiple times in the episode. Like she's angry at him, then she wants to be totally involved, she wants to go to the police
toward the end, where she's like, okay, we have to, she wants to have the adventure, and then the next scene she's like, no, we have to go to the police now, they're shooting at me, which I actually thought was a very real feeling scene of like, this all seems fun until they shoot at me and then I don't want to do this anymore, but she does it several times and I think our overarching thing that we have talked about in this is when they have these women guest stars for potential love interests for Thomas, it is surprising that the show in 8 years never actually committed to giving Thomas a girlfriend. They gave him a mysterious secret spy wife, but they never gave him like a regular girlfriend. And I think the dynamic, I think Selleck is so great with the Moonlighting-esque romantic comedy bits, and they just didn't do it. And I don't know whether that was because they were afraid that the women who watched the show weren't going to like it if Magnum wasn't single and fancy free or something. But like, I think it was a real missed opportunity.
It really was, because he is so good at that.
He is really good at it. I don't know. The rest of the plot. Okay. Jesse Hermano, the journalist, is actually part of the plot. They shoot at a bunch
and I
of
guess
stuff.
He's Geraldo.
There's a Frankie.
Basically.
Yeah, there's a Frankie.
He's like a commie supporting Geraldo.
Yeah.
I was calling him like Bobby Muchacho or.
Yeah. Well, no, Jesse Hermano. It's like literally.
Jesse brother.
Brother, Jesse brother.
Just a weird combination of
or maybe he's Dr. Joyce Spanish Brothers.
Words. We meet in part two. We meet with her friend, the undercover cop Frank, who dresses like a homeless person and has a little hat, little ratty hat. We meet Eddie the informant down at the Fifth Street Bar. Like in LA, you can just say the Fifth Street Bar, and they're like, oh, yes, yes, the Fifth Street Bar. He might know when the drug shipment is coming in, and they give him money and all of that.
They also, it looked like, I couldn't tell, did Magnum grab a bottle from the bar, or did he bring in his own bottle of cheap booze?
He grabbed a bottle, yeah.
Okay, because I was going to ask what the corkage fee at the Fifth Street Bar is.
And gave it to Eddie. Magnum breaks into stuff. There are dogs. He escapes again.
There are murderous phone company people.
Yeah. They watch Jesse Hermano's videos. And then the phone company comes to deliver the phone books in person. And you know what that means? That's a euphemism for they're going to kill you.
Ma Bell is pissed.
The explanation for why the left-wing journalist is also involved in drug smuggling is sometimes you get hooked on political conviction. And my note there is, okay. okay. I guess take that, liberal journalists. Take that. You might be selling cocaine too, or something.
The only thing I hate more than civil servants is journalists.
Is Pulitzer winning journalists. A security guard thinks that Magnum is Burt Reynolds, and so they can go and hang out in Burt Reynolds' trailer for a while. Because, again, Hollywood, the star factory where dreams come true.
That was pretty funny, actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And I will give credit where she wants to stop doing this. She doesn't want the adventure anymore. And he teases her by saying, I thought you were my Watson, my Mrs. North, my Tonto. And I was like, Mrs. North, damn. Okay, because it's a reference to Mr. and Mrs. North, the cut rate Nick and Nora Charles. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, you guys know some mystery history. Good for you.
She buys a shotgun with Magnum's help. She doesn't know the lingo. They call on Lila with the shotgun, and Lila of the comedy club reaches for her gun, but Magnum's got her gun, of course, and he gives a pitch, because it's, remember, we're in LA, he gives a pitch for the episode's plot. It says, I can never really tell a good joke, but there's a traveling cocaine salesman. He threatens to call Anton Peters and say, you're the leak, and that'll get her killed. And so anyway, they're able to find out where the big MacGuffin drug deal switcheroo is going to happen. They're sitting at the airport watching it happen. He turns to Cynthia, to Dana Delaney, and says, where's Frank, your friend from the police force? And she says, I left him a message. And I thought, wait a second, that's the best you've got, is I left him a message? I'm sure he'll be there. And they're like, it's going down. They're going to get away. At which Thomas does the heroic, no, they aren't. And there's a car chase at an airport. And then off the airport grounds. And finally, and as they're driving in the car chase, Dana Delaney admits she lied. She knew. She discovered that the screenwriter had ripped off Robin Masters, but she didn't know what to do. Her investors are dentists, again, which I think is funny.
All her friends who are dentists.
And he says...
She's a former dental hygienist turned lawyer.
Turned lawyer.
The very natural career
classic
path. And now she's a movie producer.
Yeah. And Magnum says, don't worry about it. We'll figure it out right after we get married. And she says, what? And he says, I said, we'll figure it out
later. She's not the only one who said what to that.
Yeah, that's right.
What?
Yeah.
That's kind
of a leap there, Tom.
Did I miss a reel? Did I miss another scene?
Of all the ridiculous places to ask somebody to marry them, Mm-hmm. But then Magnum does,
which he then hangs a lantern on by saying, "Of all the ridiculous
yes,
places."
Yes, yes. Then Magnum does what, for my money, might be one of the cooler things that Magnum does in all of Magnum PI, which is mm-hmm. He's chasing the blue sedan. The blue sedan is going down a street, but the cops, Frank came through, are coming the other way. So he turns around, and now he's going to be headed toward Magnum and Cynthia. Magnum turns his car sideways, gets out with the shotgun, so he's using it as a roadblock, kind of, and then gets out with the shotgun and shoots the tires out on the bad guy's car, thereby forcing them to stop and be arrested by Officer Frank. That was a cool moment. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Yeah. As car chase resolutions go, I think it was pretty good.
Yeah.
By the way, and this brings us to another segment on this podcast.
Good. Oh,
Hat Talk is back,
Hat
everybody.
Club?
It's time for Hat Talk, because Frank, her friend, who didn't get there on time, he's a lovable loser. How do we know? Friends, he's wearing a New York Mets hat. And I thought, but if there was ever...
Oh, wait a now.
But,
what? Yeah.
But this is October 1986. And he's wearing a Mets hat.
Yeah, I'm going to have to... Jason,
yep.
I believe that Hat Talk is going to be interrupted by Phil.
No.
Remote.
Hang on.
No, no. I'm just going to say, I'm going to say, I know the Mets were good in 1986. It doesn't matter. It's still a sign that he's a lovable loser.
But you know what? David knew a baseball fact.
Yeah.
Ha! Right.
Yeah. Yes,
the Mets won the World Series later this very month that this episode aired. The Mets won the World Series. So does that mean Frank is a disgusting front runner?
I think so.
Yes, yes, I can go with that.
I
don't know. I just saw that he was wearing a Mets hat and I laughed. I just thought, come on, who wears a Mets
any
hat?
Any other year, yes. Other year, he's a loser.
I think Frank wore Yankees hats and then he said, I'm done with those bombers. That Anderson, that Dave Winfield.
Yeah.
Hey,
he said, give me Doc Gooden.
Stink.
You know what
ice.
I think?
Give me.
I think Frank just wears the hat of whoever wins
give
that
me Jesse
year.
Orlando.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the kind of guy.
No,
Frank
but they haven't
is.
Won yet. So he's maybe he's like the octopus that
leading.
Picks who wins the gold medals.
They're running out there. He's got a Florida Marlins hat. You
if
know
only,
that.
If only there was a season 7.
Florida Marlins
with
didn't exist in 1986.
Wearing
I know, but
well,
but later
now,
in his career,
you've undone it, David. Now I'm very ashamed of you.
Later in his career, he got a Marlins hat. When he was the commissioner.
Yes.
Leading. Yes. Okay, Magnum calls Higgins and says, have a beautiful lay waiting for us. And Magnum's been doing these voiceovers about the American dream. And here, of course, we know his dream is going to be crushed. He's called to the white courtesy phone, leaving a sky cap hanging. Cynthia isn't coming. She says, it happened so fast. He says, I guess I'm getting impulsive in my old age. Cue my theory about season 7. And that is the end of LA, an episode
and then
there's kind of a plot that goes on a lot longer than it should, and there's a lot of character development stuff between Magnum and Cynthia that kind of amounts to nothing, and that's LA.
And we have that poetic, long, unbroken shot of beige and off-white Magnum walking down the beige and off-white hall.
Yes.
With the moving sidewalks. And there is like no color
David,
anywhere in the
it
screen.
Parallels the end of season 7 where he walks into the clouds into heaven.
Yeah. Except he doesn't look back.
And there's no John Denver playing at the LAX.
No.
An airport where you did not get murdered in the...
I'm
bathroom,
sorry, no. There's no, no more love, so there's no more saxophone.
No,
if it were O'Hare, it would have been Rhapsody in Blue.
Yes.
You know who also died in this episode was the saxophonist by the end.
David Sanborn. Special
David Sanborn.
Guest music artist.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Got a credit.
Yeah.
Truly there were no stars in heaven that night, for they were all in L.A.
That's where all the stars always are. Anyway, it's time for our letter segment.
Mm-hmm. Letters!
We got a letter, magnum@theincomparable.com, from listener Martha.
I believe arriving seconds before we press the record.
Perfect timing for Martha. Yeah. Otherwise, this
letter
would have sat for months.
Yes.
We might have mentioned Martha on the last episode where Martha did a very quick Slack message about checking out the bathroom at the Honolulu airport. We told her to run away.
And then we never heard it again.
Aloha, yeah. Guys. You've all been waiting for my update. My husband and I are enjoying the ultimate remote work setup being based out of Honolulu for the month. As noted in my Slack post, I kept a careful eye walking through the terminal as we deplaned and made our way to baggage claim. Not only are we still alive, but I can share that the restrooms have been upgraded, at least in Terminal 1. We then took a side trip to the Big Island for a few days in the Kona airport, which I have been at recently, actually, is also in the middle of an upgrade. Good to know. Maybe the bathrooms will be nicer. To share for murder, to share the ultimate crossover of hashtag Glenning, Tom Selleck and his bodyguard sat next to my then 16-year-old husband-to-be and future mother-in-law at a volleyball tournament at the Hilton Hawaiian Village back in 1986. He vaguely remembers saying hi, but otherwise not engaging in any chit-chat. The extra hashtag Glenning is that the Incomparable's own Glenn Fleischman was 2 years ahead of said husband at their high school in Eugene, Oregon, but they didn't know each other. Last but not least, we renamed our Wi-Fi network to Robin's Nest last year, and I had forgotten about it until we got here. Happy holidays, Martha. What a lovely holiday letter from Robin's Nest.
I'm so glad she's okay.
And she's okay.
It's good.
Stay away from those bathrooms at the Honolulu airport.
I was worried.
And that just about wraps it up for this episode, right, David?
Well, because it is our Christmas episode.
It is.
I have an extra special gift for you guys.
Oh,
boy.
A quiz that I actually did prepare.
Oh, boy.
Oh, hey.
As opposed to the previous one. This is a segment I like to call Mannheim PI. The challenge is the song that we play for you, is it a Mike Post TV theme song or a Mannheim Steamroller Christmas song?
Oh.
And bear in mind, these are from the extended versions of the theme songs,
sure,
that were released as singles. So some of them might surprise you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jason, as my DJ,
yes,
if you will play the first of the sample tracks, this is how we'll do it. We'll play this portion of a song. Go ahead and hit that. And then we'll guess what that song is. Is it Mike Post or Mannheim? This one's kind of a gimme.
It sounds like a Mike Post joint.
Yeah, and can you name the song?
No, because I can't. I'm sure it's the original Magnum theme.
Oh, no. Go ahead and play the second of the samples.
Oh, well, that's the extended Rockford Dance remix. Okay,
yeah, that's right. That's right.
I got it.
So sometimes you'll get it from the instrumentation, sometimes not. Mm-hmm. So for our first one, let's start with Phil.
Okay.
Since Jason is DJing, if you would press track one.
Yes, of course.
Okay, since that sounds like something that would be playing during the Main Street Electrical Parade, I'm going to go with Mannheim Steamroller.
And you are correct.
And in fact, it's themed from an electrical parade.
It's God Rest Thee Merry Gentlemen. David, I have an admission to make. My parents used to have a multi-disc changer that was entirely full of Mannheim Steamroller Christmas CD.
I was a little worried about that.
We'll see if I can do it.
I'm at a disadvantage here because not only do I not have that, I often confuse the Mannheim Steamroller with the Manhattan Transfer.
Oh, well, they're very different.
Yes. They're just the a cappella man.
You're thinking about the Trans-Siberian Orchestra, clearly.
Yes.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's right.
All right, David, is it my turn?
Okay. It is your turn. Let's go for track two.
Well, that doesn't sound familiar, and so while it sounds like a Christmas carol, I'm going to go with Mike Post.
That you are absolutely correct. And any idea what that might be?
No.
What sounds like Tales of the Gold Monkey?
It is the theme from Tales of the Gold Monkey.
Wow.
Wow, we were having a quiz and a Tales from the Gold Monkey.
Amazing.
I am all about callbacks. And a Don Belisario show.
Yes.
Of course.
Yeah.
Track three for Phil.
All right, Phil.
Okay. That's got to be Mike Post.
That is Mike Post. And it is also Don Belisario.
So is that the original Thomas Magnum Gentleman Adventurer?
No, that's Quantum Leap.
Quantum Leap.
Quantum Leap.
Can I confess that I rarely watch Quantum Leap? And if it's not Scott Bakula talking about how I'm out of time, or the narrator saying he's trying to make the last leap home, I don't know the theme.
Oh boy.
Theorizing that one could time travel within one's own lifetime, Dr. Sam Beckett stepped into the Quantum Leap Accelerator and vanished.
That's the guy.
Sam Beckett never returned home. David, that's Mannheim Steamroller.
Yeah, see, now I know you're going to know Mannheim Steamroller.
I've been steamrolled, baby.
It feels like it could be Doogie Howser. But it's Good King Wenceslas.
It's very good, close to Doogie Howser.
It is.
We should cut to Neil Patrick Harris writing
on a laptop, thinking to himself a little bit, smiling, and then writing some more.
Today I listened to a really poorly produced podcast. I feel
bad for whoever's podcast that was.
Yes.
All right, Phil, here you go. Here's
Track
number five. Ready?
Well, this is Mike Post. Yes.
Dear Diary.
Yep. We were making our Doogie Howser jokes.
But Dear Diary, this is a Mannheim
Steamroller. Oh, that's right, it is.
Oh, no! Oh.
Hark the Herald
Angels Sing.
So if you had kept, if you one more second of...
I didn't list on my CV my... encyclopedic knowledge of Mannheim Steamroller Christmas music, but let me tell you,
who knew?
I have it. This is like that time on that game show where Liz Miles got all the Doctor Who questions. It's not really fair. All right, David,
but
here's my last
random
one.
This is the last one. This is track six.
Oh, the sax. That's Mike Post for sure.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know it's Mike Post.
Is it like L.A. Law?
Yes.
It could be. Go ahead.
Yes!
That is the single version that hit the Billboard charts.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? Right?
That saxophone is so unlike.
It's weird.
I was expecting the lawyers to come out.
Yeah,
that's totally L.A. Law. And if you listen to the extended L.A. Law, it actually sounds more like this.
Yeah, of course it does. And well, Mike Post only had so many colors in his paintbrush.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the first time I heard the God Rest You Merry Gentlemen, and I'm like, that sounds like, you know, vaguely 80s action show. But then when I listened to the Magnum one, And I went, oh, I think this is a quiz.
Yeah. Oh, no,
and
that was good.
I played that segment for my 18-year-old, and I said, guess what song this is? And he's like, I don't know. And then I just hit play, and it just goes into the Magnum theme, and he's like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
I went, yes.
Well,
I know.
If only you had known that I have an encyclopedic knowledge of Mannheim Steamroller Christmas
songs. I had
songs.
No idea, because
made
who
me look
does?
Like quite the fool.
And David, when they go in there, they never come back out. They're in your brain forever.
Right. Oh, I know.
You can't get them out.
There are songs and jingles.
That's right. Jason's ears never returned home.
I mean, I was walking around the other day, not a thought in my head, and all of a sudden, once upon a time, there was an engineer. Choo-choo Charlie was his name, we hear. Why is that in my head?
I don't know. All right.
But it's there.
Well, this ends this season of Magnum P.I. Magnum Podcast, not Magnum P.I. It's over. It's been over for quite a while. But we're done with this for a while. We'll come back in like the summer or something and watch some more Magnum. Yeah. But for now, we're going to take our little break. Happy holidays to all. Send your thoughts to Magnum at theincomparable.com, and we'll get to them eventually. Send your episode suggestions if you want to dare to fall down the trap of listener Blair and be mocked. But
it's the Dare to Blair challenge.
Yes, there you go. Finally, a segment
Dare
title.
To Blair.
And any final thoughts, gentlemen, before we say goodbye?
I just want to quote the episode and say, I'm just cosmically freaked out.
More like Dana DeLonte.
Ooh, ouch.
Yeah, ouch. Ooh.
All right.
Better
well,
go to the burn unit.
Well, I have been Jason Snell, and they have been David J. Lohr and Philip Michaels. And I guess this is the time where we have to say, for a while now, bye, guys.
Aloha.
And God bless us, everyone.
I'll figure out how to do this podcast right after we get married.
Wait, what did you say?